Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Lovely to receive all of your messages last week, particularly about that interview with Ken McCallum and Neil Basu, ahead of MI5. Lots of you got in touch with that, which is very nice of you. You can always get in touch. In fact, don't get in touch. Post a comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from, but particularly on the iTunes podcast thing, because it helps with the weird mumbo-jumbo chart positions and all that. Anyway, review us. Comment, review. Lovely. Right, coming up on today's episode, big old week in politics this week. Dominic Cummings, I'm not sure if you've heard of him, but he's giving evidence to a select committee. What's a select committee, I hear you ask? Well, we explain exactly what the point of them are and how you survive one, whether you're a witness or you're asking the questions. And Patrick Kidd, Times former sketchwriter, gives us his take on the highs and lows of select committees. That's coming up in a moment. But first, we kick off with our columnist panel. And on a Monday, it's always Libby Rachie. That's Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. So let's start with your column, Libby, on the BBC. And it feels like a sort of slightly weary lament as someone who worked at the BBC for many years, seeing what's happened with the Martin Bashir case, with sort of the general... you've basically rounded up a lot of people who have, veterans of the BBC, and asked them what they think about the way the place is run.
Yes, well, I looked for people who'd been executives or very close to executives for a quite short time, who hadn't ever sort of gone native and settled down and got the big pension, to sort of see what did it feel like? What is that feeling at the executive level? And it was very, very interesting. I mean, one sort of said, you know, it's extraordinary. I mean, he'd come from commercial media, and he said, you know, this is quite extraordinary. You know, it's amazing. You want to say, hey, guys, this is fantastic. The money just keeps coming in. We don't have to have ads. You know, the license fee comes, isn't this great? He said, but at the same time, people feel incredibly hard done by, you know, all the newspapers are out to get them. And so you get this atmosphere of being loyal brother officers sticking to one another, you know, and the executive level sticking to one another against this terrible enemy. And he said the worst thing you heard constantly was, it's only the Mail, it's only the Daily Mail. And, you know, he used to say, hang on, boys, you know, this is read by a lot of people. This is public news. You know, public are paying us. Why can't we? It can't be just them, can it? It's just Murdoch. It's just the Mail. And I thought that was really interesting. And another completely different people I was talking to were drilling down into how it works within news and how the danger is that there's always some level above you can refer it up to. And if you refer it up through enough layers, the blame sort of gets sponged up like spongy flat layers of some kind of soggy cake. And the only blame then falls down onto people like Matt Wiesler. The you know, quite a lot of people have had this, but this blame down and fail upwards feeling. And it's a cultural thing. It can be dealt with. We've got a new director general now. There's been such a crisis that he's got almost a free hand. You know, he can say, look, I'm sorry, I'm going to abolish that job, that job, that job, that job. Responsibility is going to fall directly on programme editors. You will be sacked if you get it wrong. You know, there is no recourse. He could do all sorts of interesting things. Whether he will, nobody can know.
Is it because actually culturally, Libby, that when something goes wrong, the answer is to create more layers?
Absolutely. Michael Grade says there should be a whole special new board to look at stuff. And you know what it would do? It would sort of stroke its chin a lot and then recommend that another board just beyond it should be should be started. I don't think that's the answer.
What do you think, Rachel? The answer, because everyone can accept that not only did something go wrong 25 years ago, it seems to have gone wrong four or five years ago when Martin Bashir was rehired. But instead of just sort of prosecuting the specifics of the previous things, it does seem to be like a broader cultural problem at the BBC.
Well, I think there's definitely something in what Libby says, and it's brilliantly satirised, isn't it, in W1A, that BBC comedy that they did themselves. You can imagine now a head of integrity and head of connectivity being appointed to manage this whole crisis. You can see the meetings that they'd have about it all. And so I do think that, you know, obviously there was a huge deception and appalling journalistic behaviour by Martin Bashir, and then the cover-up, and then all of that. But, and there is a but for me here, I do worry that the government is just using this as part of their culture war to bash the BBC. And I don't, you know, when Oliver Dowden writing in the Times today that it's a failure that strikes at the heart of our national broadcasters' values and culture, the edges of it, I agree with Libby, there is too much kind of bureaucracy, but I don't think it strikes at the values of the BBC. And I think there's a danger that you'll lose the sort of bigger virtue and importance of having a public sector public service broadcaster. And there is an independent regulator, which is Ofcom. And so I think there's a danger that this is being used for political reasons by people who have never valued or liked the BBC and have it in for the BBC, particularly Priti Patel. Yesterday was even more excoriating than Dowden.
I suppose that could well be true, but in the way the BBC is making their life much easier for opponents of the BBC, the BBC is making their life much easier by doing this stuff. And, all, you know, every media organisation has had, you know, problems in its past, including the one that we work for now, which has been reported very enthusiastically by the BBC as if they were the paragons of virtue the whole time. And I thought Amal Rajan, when he was reporting this on the BBC on, which is all, you know, the BBC reporting the BBC, but his sort of analysis on Friday night was that, you know, at a time when the BBC is under pressure from a Conservative government, it's also under pressure from just public opinion, because if you're paying for Netflix and Amazon and Now TV, do you also want to be paying for, you know, why should you also pay for the BBC? There's a big question mark having that. And they've just this a massive own goal, Libby.
Yes, I think yes, but I think the politicians, as Rachel says, should basically butt out of it. I mean, Priti Patel seems unable to say anything without it being a threat. It seems to be her one sort of mode of discourse is threat. But actually, I wanted to be helpful. I mean, I really wanted to sort of say in this piece, look, there are these things. There is a chance. You know, things can change. There are these problems. But I think Rachel's quite right that the danger of the BBC's, you know, all the very many, and I say at the end, the very many good people with terrific BBC values, you know, being sort of hurled aside just because they haven't agreed with a particular government's line on certain things is very dangerous. I wish the politicians would just step back now and watch what Tim Davey does. And I hope Tim Davey is going to take a firm grip. The last Director General didn't. I mean, Tony Hall, I had huge hopes of Tony Hall. You know, I was completely convinced that he would be a great thing, and then he just wasn't. He's very amiable, he's a very good person with very good values, and he seemed to turn out weak, and you know, it makes you sob.
But what about the general idea that maybe if the BBC focused on the part of the reason why it gets criticised is whether it's, you know, local websites which overtook local newspapers, you know, doing more and more commercial stuff, posting recipes on its website and all that sort of stuff. If the BBC was slimmed down to doing the job of a public service broadcaster, it would be less open to some of this criticism, wouldn't it, Rachel?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a case for that. I don't see quite why they have endless, you know, recipe websites or whatever. But I think that's not to do with the kind of heart and values of the BBC. That's almost to sort of get rid of the extraneous stuff. And then meanwhile, I think I worry when they cut the World Service and they cut funding for things that actually is protecting British values abroad, and you'd hope that that would be continued and expanded. So I think it just depends on what you're focusing on. And you're right, you do need to prioritise, but that doesn't mean kind of cutting and hacking back the whole thing.
Well, that's probably enough.
As long as Radio 4 goes on commissioning a series of Mark Steels in Town, then I'm absolutely on the BBC's side. I have to just tell you, everybody, listen to Mark Steels in Town, because it makes you love Britain so much. People cheering at being mocked by Mark Steel. It's brilliant.
I must be honest, I'm aware that Radio 4 was still going since Times Radio launched, but apparently it is. Apparently it is, if only for Mark Steel. Right, Libby.
All you are is talk, man. Talk, you're all talk.
All talk and no trousers or something. Rachel, let's talk about the Times Education Commission, in which you're chairing. I mean, it's quite a job you've got, even chairing this thing. Explain what the Times Education Commission is, first of all.
Yeah, so the Times is going to be spending, I'm going to be chairing this thing over the next year, and we're going to be looking at the whole education system in the light of the pandemic, new technology, changing nature of work, and the way in which the world has moved on, really, and just say, is what's fit for purpose and what isn't. And none of the politicians seem to really be looking at this seriously at all. Mm. So we're going to look at everything from social mobility and that sort of appalling gap between rich and poor pupils, where the disadvantaged are 18 months behind the more advantaged by the time they do their GCSEs. We're going to be looking at the curriculum. We're going to be looking at testing and whether GCSEs are still the right way forward. We're going to be looking at whether children are ready for the workplace, for life, mental health, and all those problems. We got a poll in the paper today which says that only a third of parents think that the education system prepares their children for either work or life. And that is a problem. So we're going to look at what we can do to make it better.
I suppose that's a big sort of existential question of what is the point of education to some extent. Is it learning for the sake of learning and the beauty of, you know, more about the world we live in? Or is it to churn out people who are ready for the workplace? And I suppose that's before you even get on to what we should do. What's your sense, Rachel, as to where the education system should be?
Well, also, what does it mean ready for the workplace, and what does it mean education for the sake of it? Because I think sometimes what's happened is that the system that we've got at the moment, it doesn't encourage either of those things. So I've interviewed Lucy Kellaway, who's one of our commissioners, and she's a maths teacher now in a Hackney comprehensive. She was a FT columnist. And she says, actually, she feels that the exam system and the kind of rote learning and the rigmarole of the mark scheme is disadvantaging all her pupils, so that she's, you know, they're so stuck, it's impossible. She said she was in an economics class the other day, and a pupil asked a really fascinating question about tax. And if they'd spent the whole hour discussing that, the children would have just learnt a huge amount. There would have been a huge, they'd have been much better prepared for work, and also learnt a lot for the sake of learning. But she couldn't, because she had to get through six more slides to prepare them for their exam so they could get the right answer in the exam technique, you know, process. And there's that sense that it's not fulfilling either of those things. So I think we need more creativity, more, less kind of mark scheme minutiae of the curriculum, more freedom and flexibility, more sort of teamwork and ability to work on projects together, rather than just, you know, stuffing facts into children.
Libby, you've spent a long time reporting on education, and we go sort of slightly through these waves, and it feels like, you know, 10 years ago, Michael Gove, you know, more and more knowledge almost learning by rote, and children had to memorise all this stuff for their exams, and now that sort of feels like it's going out of fashion again.
Yes, I'm loving the Education Commission. I hope it's going to have some really good arguments. I hope Rachel is going to stir up some people, you know, who say extreme on one side, extreme on the other. It's got to argue with itself. I mean, I'm fascinated by it. There are so many interesting things. The business of longer days or not is interesting. And so is the whole business of what's called parity of esteem for technical education. And I'd like to sort of think of technical education always running alongside a much wider, relaxed cultural offer, so that you may be training to be an absolutely sort of top nuclear scientist, or indeed a plumber or a riveter or an engineer. And at the same time, it would be kind of assumed that there would be without exams, there would be music, there would be some poetry, there would be some drama, there would be a wider cultural offer alongside. Some countries do this. Just the sense that people are rounded creatures, you know, that you can't say, OK, we're turning out some very good technicians. OK, we're turning out some very good physicists. You know, you want to say we're turning out some people who are able to think sideways and appreciate things more widely. I mean, I love the fact that the guy who did my two eye operations years ago was a very accomplished cellist. You know, I thought, yes, you know, that's what we need. You know, handle and eyes. I think that this is all part of education. I don't know what Rachel feels. I'd like to hear some
big arguments.
I
totally agree, yeah. And I was speaking to Andrea Schleicher, who's the sort of OECD big international guru on what works around the world. And he said it's in other countries, they don't have this sense of extracurricular activities. You know, music, drama, art, sport are part of the curriculum. And the sense that
it's not hived off. Yeah,
exactly. The best education systems see the child as a whole child, and they're trying to develop all their talents, not just for exams, but for the sake of their sort of identity and their creativity.
Because people are whole people. I mean, they used to be, you know, the Workers' Educational Association, you know, they used to be miners' philosophical societies in the northern pit towns. You know, people need both sides. And I think we get a great split now. You know, you're an intellectual, you talk intellectually things, you know, you're a practical child. We need to spread this out and allow people to be whole people.
Or you're a scientist, you're an artist, you're humanities, you're English, you're maths. It shouldn't have to be a choice, I agree.
Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester then. Of course, you can read them both in The Times every week. Just get yourself a Times subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/Times Redbox. Up next, what's a select committee?
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Redbox podcast. Now it's time for this. When the crowd say ball, select committee. When the crowd say ball, select committee. This goes out to all the DJs. Yeah, so Dominic Cummings, never mind the DJs, the DC we're talking about. Dominic Cummings up in front of this joint committee, the Science and Technology and Health Committee's inquiry into the government's handling of the coronavirus outbreak last year. He's giving evidence on Wednesday morning. I mean, he's been tweeting a lot about it, so we already know quite a lot of what he's going to say. But sometimes, I'm conscious, we talk a lot about select committees without necessarily knowing exactly what they're all about. What's the point of them? What can they actually achieve? So that's what we thought we'd try and explain this morning. We'll find out exactly what a select committee is, how they have the power to call up, whether it's former prime ministers, former officials, quite often a few celebrities too. And so what we're going to do is sort of pick our way through them. Joined this morning by Scott Colvin, a political advisor to businesses and the author of How to Survive a Select Committee. Morning, Scott.
Morning, Matt.
Thanks so much for joining us. You're the sort of you're the one that primes the witnesses for a select committee. We've also got Siobhan McDonough, the Labour MP for Mitcham and Morden, who sits on the Treasury Select Committee. Morning, Siobhan.
Good morning.
Now, Siobhan, you're the sort of the attack dog of the Select Committee. You're representing all attack dogs. Listeners may remember Siobhan taking Lex Greensill to task earlier this month.
Mr. Greensill, are you a fraudster?
No, Ms. McDonough, I am not.
An absolute belter. You also put David Cameron very much in his place. I'm frankly scared, Siobhan, because you're sitting in the chair on the Zoom where you've given all these people a kick. I feel like I'm in the firing line at the Select Committee. And we're also joined by Patrick Kidd, the Times editor of the Times Diary, who spent many years sketching some of the best and worst Select Committees. Morning, Patrick.
Morning, Matt.
Nice to have you with us. So I'll tell you what, Scott, as let's Siobhan, first of all, what is a Select Committee? How do you get on one? You're on a Select Committee. Who's on it? Who's in charge? How are they supposed to work?
Well, it's about scrutinising the government over major areas of service. As you said, I'm on the Treasury Select Committee. So we look at the work of the Treasury, how finance works and how the regulators work. The majority of places go to the governing backbenchers of the governing party, but the opposition is represented, and in our case, we also have an SNP MP, Alison Thewlis, in proportion to our numbers in the House of Commons. And I never thought that being on the Treasury Select Committee was going to be quite so exciting.
Well, because there is that, because obviously every so often there are blockbuster hearings, whether it's with Lex Greensill or David Cameron or Dominic Cummings. But quite often you pick a sort of it might be a government policy or a particular issue, maybe a year on from a government policy, to sort of basically take evidence from lots of people affected by it and then produce a report on whether that policy has worked or maybe suggest some new ideas.
Absolutely. We're looking at the moment at the economy after coronavirus and the grants that were awarded to business and generally what the outlook for the economy is. So most of the time it's very interesting but fairly dry stuff that people wouldn't necessarily want to watch.
OK, so that's a perspective from Siobhan as a member of a Select Committee. Now, Scott, you've literally written the book on this, but you spent a long time preparing people to go in front of people like Siobhan. So how do you go about doing that? What sort of people have you prepped to appear in front of a Select Committee?
Well, they're one of the most terrifying experiences, particularly if you're in the private sector. I mean, genuinely, if you've got a chief executive who's pretty well experienced and has done AGMs, the Today programme, you know, all range of kind of difficult moments, they always tell me Select Committee is the most terrifying of all, because you just have no idea what type of questions you're going to get. You know, with David Cameron, when he appeared before the Treasury Committee, you know, there are literally just 1,000 different questions he could have been asked. So trying to prep and prepare for every eventuality is the bit that makes it really stressful and high pressure.
And so how do you do that? So because I suppose what you can't do if you're prepping someone to appear on the radio, for instance, it might be a 5-minute interview, a bit of waffle and a bit of evasion, you can probably get through that. But you could be in front of a Select Committee for an hour, 2 hours sometimes. So how do you prepare someone? Because at some point, they're going to face questions they don't really want to answer.
Well, I mean, in the case of Philip Green with the BHS scandal, he was before the committee for 6 hours, like without a break, and on his own as well. So I can't, I haven't got a great deal of sympathy for him, but in terms of, an experience like that, it's unprecedented. 6 hours of facing, relentless questioning. Tend to do is I would always, for example, always get the witness in the mindset of the importance and relevance of a committee. You know, the committee is representative of the people. You know, it's a group of democratically elected MPs who get to ask these questions, and it's absolutely right they get to ask those questions. So first of all, we always have respect for the committee and its right to ask those questions, but also, be prepared for every eventuality. You've got to be willing to answer questions on everything from how much you're paid to the performance of your company, or if you're a minister, decisions that were made with civil servants. So, it can be really difficult. But, for me, the success in a Select Committee appearance is that people don't remember that you ever appear.
Right. So that's your top advice. Right. Before we come to Patrick Kidd, let's pick through some highlights of Select Committees. Scott, you just mentioned there, Philip Green, 6 hours he was up in front of the committee for. He didn't really enjoy the whole process at all, including this moment where Tory MP Richard Fuller was apparently looking at him too much and he really didn't like it. Let's take a listen.
Could you, sir, do you mind not looking at me like that all the time? It's really disturbing. No, you just want to stare at me. It's just uncomfortable, that's all.
I wasn't quite just staring at you, but I don't wish to make you uncomfortable.
Sorry?
I don't wish to make you uncomfortable.
No, but I'm just saying. This is somebody else, but it's just uncomfortable sort of staring at me.
So that was Philip Green. He was giving evidence about the collapse of BHS back in June 2016. Didn't like the MPs even looking at him. David Davis, when he was Brexit Secretary, he spent a lot of time in front of select committees, including this memorable moment when, having claimed for ages that there were impact assessments and so on into every possible sector of the impact of Brexit, he then later admitted that the government had made no assessment of the impact of Brexit on the UK economy in December 2017. Let's take a listen.
So there isn't one, for example, on the automotive sector?
On the
automotive
no,
sector?
No, not that I'm aware of, no.
Is there one on aerospace?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
No. One on financial services?
Well, I think the answer's going to be no to all of them.
No to all of them, yeah. Right. Now, doesn't it strike you, Secretary of State, as rather strange, given experience around the committee in which you have, the government undertakes impact assessments on all sorts of things all of the time, that on the most fundamental change that we are facing as a country, you've just told us that the government hasn't undertaken any impact assessments at all.
Yeah, that was quite a moment and definitely came back to haunt David Davis. That his impact assessments, I remember you said they were in excruciating detail, but also did not exist. Jeremy Corbyn, when he appeared in front of the Home Affairs Select Committee, he was told off because his supporters sitting behind him kept passing him notes. This is in July 2016.
Surely you need to go to the heart of the question and say it what it is, which is racist and anti-Semitic. And you don't need to look at these post-it notes coming from behind. You can ask the question.
Sorry, can I just say to Mr. Rotherham and Ms. Chakrabarty, it's not really in order to keep passing notes to the witness constantly.
He doesn't have to be briefed as to whether
or whispering to the witness.
You don't need a prompt.
There is no need to do that.
You don't
no, you may not, Mr. Rotherham.
If you don't need to be prompted to say it as it is. Kane
Livingstone. There we are. So that was Jeremy Corbyn facing questions on anti-Semitism in the Labour Party in July 2016. One more clip for a moment. It goes back to what Scott was saying about basically the aim of business leaders is to avoid saying anything. This was what happened when Matt Britton in February 2016, he was the boss of Google. He was asked a straightforward question by Meg Hillier on the Public Accounts Committee of how much he got paid. And he really didn't want to tell her.
What do you get paid, Mr. Britton?
If that's relevant, I'll happily disclose that to the committee. What I understand is...
No, I'm asking what you get paid.
I'll happily disclose that if that's a relevant matter for the committee.
I'm asking you, so it's a relevant matter. Could you tell me what you get paid, please, Mr.
I don't have the figure, but I'll happily provide
you
it
You don't
to the
know
afterwards.
What you get paid, Mr.
Chair.
Perhaps you could give us a ballpark of what you get paid. Forget the share options, then. What's your basic salary?
It's a salary. I don't have the figure, but I'll provide the figure privately if it's relevant to the committee to understand myself.
Yeah, he never came clear. Right, so Patrick Kidd, former sketchwriter of The Times, editor of The Times Diary. Hi, Patrick. So some of those highlights and lowlights, what makes a good select committee appearance to sketch?
You can't always tell when it's going to come, is the thing. As has rightly been said, you're there for much longer than a debate. And sometimes you're nodding off quietly in the corner and then suddenly someone's committed news. And your antennae has to sort of brighten up. I mean, the thing you have to remember is that the inquisitors sit there in a horseshoe. And normally 11 of them. Do you know why there's 11, by the way? Your nerdy fact of the day. This goes back to Disraeli, who said that the ideal size for a committee should be 11 because it works for a cricket team. and you're never quite sure who's going to be hitting you in what order on what subject. And so Philip Green, I was in the room for that one, probably for most of the 6 hours. He was immensely jumpy. It wasn't just you play the clip of the MP looking at him. I remember he got very upset because Jeremy Quinn fiddled with his glasses. And that's upset. And then he had to go at Richard Graham, who, again, you're asking difficult questions. Well, that's what they meant to do. And I remember at one point, suddenly the bell went, and it was for the start of prayers in the Commons Chamber. And Green sort of got up as if to go, as if he was like a schoolboy who thought that was break time. And was told, no, that's for us, not you. So you just sit there and you wait, and sometimes there can be really dry, dull stuff. And then suddenly someone will... Well, for instance, in the Foreign Affairs Select Committee once, Boris Johnson got into all sorts of trouble over Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe.
In fact, we could take a listen to that one, because I was going to say that sometimes there is some actual news that emerges rather than sort of powerful people being put in the stocks. This is when Boris Johnson really did commit news.
When you look at what Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe was doing, it's just, you know, she was simply teaching people journalism, as I understand it, at the very limit. She was, and I hope that a way forward can be found. I must say, I find it deeply depressing. I think it's totally contrary to the interests of the Iranian people for this to continue.
And of course, famously, that was very much not the case. The government line on Nazanin was that she was not working, training journalists at all. But those comments were seized on by the Iranian regime to threaten her with more years in prison. So sometimes news does emerge from it, Patrick.
I was just going to say quickly on that. He got in such trouble that his next appearance before the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, sent along her PPS to actually sit at the back. And this was pointed out. Boris wasn't aware of this. And Tom Tugendhat, the chairman, said, asked, are you always putting your foot in your mouth? And he said no. And he said, well, why in that case has the Prime Minister's PPS been sent along? And Boris turned around. Oh, Seema. Ah, yes. And that was the debate where he then likened Vladimir Putin to Hitler. So, I mean, it clearly didn't work.
That didn't work either. Another time when news came out of a select committee was when Amber Rudd, of course, was up in front of the Home Affairs Select Committee, denying that there were targets for removing people from the UK. This is back in April 2018. Remember, not long after this exchange, she ended up having to resign. Let's take a listen.
We don't have targets for removals, but you did. I don't know what are you referring to?
We've just heard from the previous evidence that the Home Office and individual, there are regional targets for net removals.
I didn't hear the testimony. I'm not sure what shape that might be in. But if you're asking me are the numbers of people we expect to be removed, that's not how we operate.
And of course, that turned out not to be quite the case, and she resigned soon after. Siobhan McDonough, as an MP on a committee, is that the sort of the sort of absolute gold standard that you're aiming for, the idea of an exchange at a select committee which leads to someone's resignation? That's the jackpot.
No, you're trying to elicit information. I mean, particularly at the moment when the House of Commons isn't really acting and holding the government to account in a way it should, because there's so few people allowed in the chamber and you have to get a position to on a list to speak. I think probably select committees are the only opportunity to really question a minister or a businessman or woman, or as in our case, a former Prime Minister, David Cameron, who did try the trick of talking slowly and completely waffling and not telling us how much he earned for Greensill.
And I suppose, what can you do in terms of the powers that a select committee has? Because in America, people are subpoenaed and that sort of thing to give evidence. In fact, famously, Dominic Cummings refused to give evidence to a parliamentary committee in the past. What powers does a committee have to force people to come and give evidence and then to offer up things like how much money David Cameron might be making from Greensill, you know, how much the boss of Google might earn? What powers does the committee actually have?
I think that eventually you can subpoena people along, but people will generally come to the committee if they know they're asked, because they don't want to be dragged kicking and screaming, because that's going to make it so much worse by the time they get in front of us. I mean, we weren't successful in finding out how much David Cameron got from Greensill. So I don't know how much, if somebody really isn't prepared to tell you, the fact is that everybody knows that's the case, and that's an embarrassing place to be in.
I suppose that's the thing, is that there's getting information, neat, but then, you know, there's a bit of public damage and embarrassment that goes along with it.
Yeah.
People don't pay ball. I'll tell you what, right, up next, I want to ask about particularly celebrities appearing at select committees and what the point of that is. We'll do that next here on Times Radio.
Times Radio with Matt Chorley.
Yeah, we're taking a look at select committees, how they work and what is the point of them. Let's turn our attention now to when quite often, you know, select committees like to, you know, it's a chance to meet some famous people. Call in a celebrity or two to a select committee. First of all, this was Russell Brand on drugs, discussing them specifically at the Home Affairs Committee back in April 2012.
I think we're running out of time. I have a final question about...
Time is infinite.
Unfortunately,
we
have...
we cannot run out of time.
It is. But for this committee...
Who's next? Theresa May. She may not show up. Check she knows what day it is.
Mr. Brand, I have a final question for you.
That was Russell Brand undermining the entire construct of a select committee there with Keith Vaz. That was back in 2012. More recent, in fact, Jamie Oliver has been up in front of select committee several times. This was Jamie Oliver and Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall at the Health Committee in May 2018 discussing sugar in milkshakes.
This is a bottle of strawberry
Yazoo.
This is a Mars milk drink. We've got 33 grams of sugar.
And Buddy's hacked this one against EU legislation. That's got 9 teaspoons in of total sugars.
So, Siobhan, what's the value of calling in a celebrity apart from just getting meeting your heroes or getting a bit of attention for your committee?
Yeah, I think both of those, but also highlighting an issue. So the issue of healthy eating, it can be quite dull. But I imagine if you've got a few celebrity chefs, you're going to get much more attention for the arguments that you're having. I have to say, I mean, that is not a big part of select committees. As I said, most of it is quite dull. So if you can get a celebrity in there, perhaps it gets a bit more exciting. I remember is when Rupert Murdoch had the pie in his face. I think it was the business select committee.
Yeah, I think that's right. That was back in the days of the phone hacking hearing. I mean, it doesn't get more spectacular than that, the custard pie being thrown around.
No.
But I suppose it's more difficult to do that on Zoom these days. It's difficult to throw a virtual custard pie at the boss. Yeah. Scott, what do you do about advising people? There'll be a little bit there of Russell Brand sort of undermining the whole, basis of it. I was also remembering, what's his name? Aaron Banks. Aaron Banks was up in front of a select committee and then just suddenly decided, this was back in June 2018, just decided he'd had enough and got up and walked out. Let's take a listen to that, first of all.
I really had to insist. I was told a certain time, and we've got a luncheon appointment. We don't want to be late for.
You can join us if you want. We'll be in the...
Does someone want to take a
Puppet? Mr. Max, could you just give us 5 minutes of your time?
No, you said when you left 20 minutes, and now we've run way past 20 minutes.
And off he went to lunch. So, Scott, is that something you would advise someone to do, that if they've had enough of a select committee, just announce I'm off to lunch?
Well, no, not really. Just as one quick aside on the celebrity thing, I know that when Damien Collins was the culture, media, sport select committee chair, he used to call in Gary Neville just because he's a massive Man United fan and liked hanging out with him. But just on Aaron Banks, interestingly, there's a very small category of people, because actually the committees don't have the power to force you to appear, unlike in, say, France, where you can get a fine. It's £7,500 fine if you refuse to appear. Most of the reason that you end up appearing is because of the reputational damage if you don't. But there's a very small category of people, and Dominic Cummings used to be in that category, and Aaron Banks definitely is in that category, along with Andy Wigmore, who we appeared with on that day, which is, if you are sort of positioning yourself as a bad boy of politics or of business, then you can treat the committee with complete disregard, because you don't really care about the impact it has on your business. You don't really care about how people write about you in the media as a result. And that was a classic one where, I mean, Aaron Banks basically accused the chair of, you know, colluding with the Russians and taking backhanders and, you know, being drunk in bars and all sorts of crazy stuff. So, you know, that is a very small proportion of the witnesses that can literally stick two fingers up at the committee.
I just wanted to bring go on, Siobhan.
I just wanted to ask Scott a question. My understanding is that training of people who are witnesses at select committees got going because of Margaret Hodge when she was chair of the Public Accounts Committee, and that indeed people were more frightened of being in front of her than absolutely anybody else.
Yeah, but Margaret Hodge was utterly terrifying. I mean, the big change actually came in 2010. They changed the rules about these select committee chairs used to be selected by party whips. So you gave it to loyal people, maybe at the end of their careers. In 2010, it became an election of the whole House. So you had to be, as a Labour chair, you had to be elected also by Conservative MPs. So it led to the rise of these really independent, fierce people like Margaret Hodge and Keith Vaz and Damien Collins and Andrew Tyrie. Margaret Hodge absolutely was, without question, the most terrifying secretary chair probably in history.
So, OK, then let's look ahead to Dominic Cummings on Wednesday. First of all, Scott, if you were advising Dominic Cummings, what would be your advice to him today ahead of Wednesday? How would you prepare him?
Well, if I'd spoken to him a week ago, I would have said, don't post 51 tweets over the course of the weekend. Because, frankly, I mean, I'm interested in this topic, but I was bored to tears by tweet 51. I think he's built it up too much. You know, unless he's got some staggering new piece of information he's going to reveal on the day or some audio recording, I just think he's bored everyone to tears. And, you know, for him, with everybody on the select committee, you just want three or five maximum messages that you're going to try and get across in the course of the session. But he's already given us 51. So what's left to say?
OK, Siobhan, if you were on the committee on Wednesday, what would you like to ask Dominic Cummings?
Oh, what a great question. What does he think of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister? Is he up to the job?
I think we've got a slight flavour of what the answer to that might be, but that's a very good question. And it's a classic question from an MP on a select committee. She's got nothing to do with the inquiry, but it's likely to elicit a good news story. And Patrick, if you were in the gallery, virtual or otherwise, watching the select committee on Wednesday, what would make it ideal for sketch writers?
Well, I mean, hopefully some props. I remember Jamie Oliver bought in a box full of drinks and handed them out to everyone. So if Damien, if Cummings came in and actually played, put a jukebox down on the desk and started playing. But the other thing is, he has said he will take questions for as long as they want, which is fascinating. So I hope they hold him to that. But also, he spent all this time in these 51 tweets saying how incompetent everyone is. So I'd like one question to be, Mr. Cummings, why do you think things have suddenly got much better since you left Downing Street?
Yeah, he does. His position does seem to be everything was absolutely awful. If only there was somebody in charge who, I mean, given that we were led to believe that he was basically running the show, there is something really interesting in that. I just wanted to round off with one of my favourite clips, a very recent clip, this one. Sometimes it's the witness which goes slightly off piste, but when the committee themselves start squabbling amongst themselves, this was Douglas Ross, Tory MP on the Scottish Affairs Committee, taking aim at his chairman, Pete Wishart, at the Scottish Affairs Committee earlier on this month. Let's take a listen.
And I have to say at the outset how disappointed people must have been to watch the, quite frankly, inept and poor chairing of this committee so far by Mr. Wishart. And I think people will understand why members of his own party and across
Listen,
Parliament...
Listen, Douglas, Douglas Ross. There's no need at all to make attacks on the chair of this committee. I've been elected by the House to chair this committee. Could you please just get on with addressing your questions? No, I'm just trying to get on with doing my job without any sort of personal attacks like that. Please get on with your questions.
When you're so poor at your job, I will personally attack you because you have talked over witnesses repeatedly.
This is just absolutely pathetic. Will you please just get on with your questions without making any sort of erroneous attacks on the chair?
And on and on and on it went. Siobhan, have you ever been tempted to attack your chair in the same way?
No, I think you have to try and charm your chair to make sure you get the questions that you want.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.